Yes, anti-Semitism, Islamic jihadism, Muslim Brotherhood. These terms are definitively interwoven. You can't be an Islamic jihadist without embracing an anti-Semitic outlook. It's definitive and foundational. And most Islamic jihadist movements in the world are traceable through like a genealogical tree to the Muslim Brotherhood. I'm going to say a few words about historical background. It is the jihadism we're talking about is Islamic. This is not to make a claim about Islam or Muslims. I'm using Islamic jihadism intentionally and jihadists rather than Islam and Muslims. Islam is many, many, many things, as we all know. However, there are, you know, elements of anti-Semitic, anti-Judaic thinking from the get-go. And this is a famous line from the Quran: the Jews, are those whom Allah has cast aside, on whom his wrath has fallen, and of whom he has made some as apes and swine. The Quran denounces the Jewish scriptures and the Jews, saying that the Jews are falsifiers of the word. So the Jews from the get-go are dehumanized and identified with lies. Okay, the source of lies. And as some of you perhaps know, during the lifetime of Muhammad, there were battles fought with Jewish tribes. The Jewish tribe, the Banu Qurayza, was wiped out. The men were wiped out. And the Banu Nadir, Banu Kanuka tribes were expelled from the peninsula. So you have this tension immediately as we move forward into the centuries. You have statements like this one from Ibn Tumar to Morocco, saying, "Come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance." Okay, so this is no more in remembrance. At this point, becomes a matter of redemption. In other words, it's a matter of purification. Ibn Tumar was a purist, and already in the 11th century and into the 12th century, you have this purist movement in Islam, and Islamic jihadism is a purist movement. Purist movements are invariably anti-Semitic, whether it's Islamic or National Socialist or, you know, other such movements. During the time of the Crusades, across North Africa and Southern Spain, we have what's known as the Almohad persecutions. Ibn Tumar anticipated this turn in history, which was again a purist movement, and the primary source of contamination is the Jews. There's a great deal of hatred toward the Crusaders, of course, absolutely, but the Christians stem from the Jews. The original contamination that the Christians represent comes from the Jews. Now, very often you'll hear it said, well, you know, the Jews always had fairly good relations with the Muslims historically, in contrast to the problematic relations that we've had with the Christians. But yeah, I would say not exactly. Depends on when and where we're talking about. And these are some examples of violence against the Jews historically in Egypt, Syria, Yemen, North Africa. I should have included here the Granada massacre of 1066, which is notorious. By the 19th century, with the Damascus affair of 1840, which was a blood libel, you have the import of the canards of anti-Semitism from Christian Europe brought into the Middle East, and it finds its way, certainly, as you all know, there's blood libel throughout the Islamic jihadist discourse now. So the relationships have not always been friendly. There is precedence for Islamic animosity toward the Jews prior to the advent of Islamic jihadism as we know it today. Today's the Islamic jihadism that we know of today, I would argue, is part of a reaction to modernity. Jihad has been a category of Islamic thought from, at least from, I would say, the 8th century. You know, within 100 years, as soon as you have the first schools of law unfolding, such as the Hanbali school mentioned here, you have the category of jihad at work in Islamic thinking. Wahhabism is a purist movement that rose in the 18th century, 1744, and in reaction to modernity. Modernity here is the Enlightenment, right? The age of reason. The age that is increasingly hostile toward revealed religion. Okay, so, and it's also an age of European expansion, colonialism, and so on. So in the Islamic world, you have this, let's say, suspicion of this contamination. So the Wahhabism set out to purify Islam, not only of the European contamination, but the pre-Islamic pagan practices. They wanted to purify Islam of Muslim scholasticism, which is Aristotelian thinking, right? Philosophy, rationalism, reason, which was very prominent in the Middle Ages. Averroes, Ibn Sina, or famous Muslim scholastic philosophers influenced by Aristotle, and they also see the teachings of the Sufis as the source of contamination. Wahhabism is heavily influenced by the Hanbali school, which is a school that promotes jihad as holy war. Okay, in the 19th century, Salafism, a term that means purification, the purest, going back to the beginning, was a school that arose in Al-Azhar University. This is significant for the Muslim Brotherhood, especially in the Salafist figure, Rashad Rida. Rashad Rida had a huge influence on the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Brotherhood's founder, Hassan al-Banna, regarded Rashad Rida as one of his key teachers. Okay. Hassan al-Banna was also Egyptian, living in a British-controlled Egypt, living in, you know, in a time of Western colonialism, a time of what he saw to be corruption. And so in March of 1928, he and five or six others, a small handful of men, established the Muslim Brotherhood, the Ikhwan. And this is their creed. Okay, this is their creed. And this is the beginning of at this time, a bit of a departure from traditional Islam, that the departure would become greater, I would argue, as the Brotherhood progresses. I mean, it's you think Allah is our goal, that's looks good enough. Prophet is our leader, fine. Quran is our law, okay. Jihad is our way, but what does jihad mean? Jihad is the path of holy war, of the sword. It's the path of the sword. As the Ayatollah Khomeini said, also influenced by the Brotherhood, everything glorious that has ever come to Islam has come through the sword, and therefore death in the service of Allah is our highest desire. Death in the service of Allah means death in the process of inflicting death. And the main target would soon become the Jews. Abana takes jihad to be something like a sixth pillar of the faith. Every Muslim has to engage in jihad. There's no escape. To avoid jihad, to avoid holy war, to avoid supporting it physically, financially, raising your children to be jihadists is to incur one of the mortal sins that will guarantee your damnation, right? Zakat, charity, which is one of the five pillars, can be performed by donating money and other materials to the jihadist movements, okay? That becomes not just to the poor, the jihadists. And we have this teaching from Albana, who's known for his phrase, the mastery of the art of death, the fan al-mat, to love death more than life. Glorifying death, making murder into martyrdom. I think this is worth pointing out at this point that Ruhollah Khomeini studied with the Brotherhood, met Albana in 1937, who would turn out to be a big influence on him. Haji Amin al-Husseini was close to the Brotherhood in the 1930s and became even closer in 1946. Haji Amin al-Husseini was the Mufti of Jerusalem. He had to flee Palestine in 1937. He became a collaborator with the Nazis. He recruited Muslim killing units for the SS in the Balkans. He was a war criminal. He turned up in Cairo in June 1946 and received a hero's welcome from Albana and Sayyid Qutb as well. A couple of months later, he brought his relative, Yasser Arafat, to Egypt to be trained by the Brotherhood, to be indoctrinated by the Brotherhood. At this point, 1946, many of those in the Brotherhood giving military training to their guys were former Nazi soldiers. Now, it's at this point that the Brotherhood takes on a more systematic ideological foundation with Sayyid Qutb. Albana has, you know, his own writings. The writings of Albana, from an ideological standpoint, are not quite as influential as the writings of Sayyid Qutb. The Ayatollah Khomeini translated Qutb's writings into Farsi. Qutb is probably the most widely read jihadist ideologue in the world. I mean, there are other important ones, certainly. But everyone who comes after Qutb among the jihadists is indebted to Qutb. And of course, Qutb is famous for his diatribes against the Jews. He wrote a work called Our Struggle Against the Jews. His work, Milestones, is a key in his jihadist ideology and the anti-Semitism that lies at its core. So here, he explains, you know, among other things, among his teachings, that jihad is warfare. It's a militant movement. It's not this cheshbon nefesh, it's taking stock of yourself, your soul. And it's really with Qutb, I mean, you see it before Qutb, certainly, absolutely. But Qutb really goes in his work, Our Struggle with the Jews, into this demonization of the Jews. Here, it's not that all Jews are evil, but that all evil is Jewish. So the purification of the world, the purging of the world of this contamination of evil, requires the extermination of the Jews. It's got nothing to do with the Jewish state. The Jewish state is a problem, not because it's, you know, a state established on the end of the Mediterranean, but because it's Jewish. They are the eternal enemy, not just our current enemy. They plague humanity as clearly shown in the protocols of the Elders of Zion. So indeed, in the Hamas Charter, there are three basically sacred texts that are invoked to demonstrate the truth of the demonic character of the Jew. Those texts are the Quran, selections from the Hadith, and the protocols of the Elders of Zion. Another important ideologue from the 70s on, I would say, is Yusuf al-Qaradawi. Al-Qaradawi is a very prolific writer, has a broad influence in academia. He was affiliated with Oxford University. An example of al-Qaradawi's prayer regarding the Jews. O Allah, take the Jews, the treacherous aggressors. O Allah, take this profligate, cunning, arrogant band of people. O Allah, they've spread much tyranny and corruption in the land. Pour your wrath out upon them. Our God is in wait for them. Take this, and so on. Jewish Zionist band of people. By the way, Zionist is a synonym for Jewish here. It's not just Theodore Herzl and those after him who wanted to, seek a Jewish haven. This purging of the Jewish presence has to be total. Do not spare a single one of them. Count their numbers, kill them down to the last one. To tolerate the presence of a single Jew is like tolerating the presence of a case of some horrific disease. So the Brotherhood, with the death of Sayyid Qutb, the Brotherhood branched out, and indeed the Brotherhood was branching out from the beginning, from the 1930s even. When I say branching out, I mean going from Egypt into Syria, Lebanon, Sudan, Gaza. One of those who was sent into Gaza by the Brotherhood to establish a center for Islamic studies was Ahmed Yassin, who was the founder of Hamas. I'm sure all of you know of Hamas, have heard of Hamas. You've heard and seen the support for Hamas shown this last summer by various academic organizations. And this is the thinking of Hamas and its founder. Killing Jews is not just an unpleasant necessity. It's an act of devotion. It's something holy and pleasing to God. Your ticket to paradise is the blood of a Jew. An act of devotion. And we have statements, familiar statements, such as this from Yassin, that the Jewish state has to disappear. Jihad is the duty of everyone to establish the rule of Allah throughout the earth. The problem with America is its Zionist views. In fact, America is controlled by Zionists, according to this view. America and Israel are tied, ideologically tied here, and are equally evil, the two Satans. Abdul Azzam, another member of the Brotherhood, Azzam is the author of a work widely read called Join the Caravan. Azzam, heavily influenced by Qutb. Azzam supposedly drafted much of the Hamas Charter. The Hamas Charter, which by the way is known as the Charter of Allah, suggesting that Hamas is Allah. What characterizes Islamic jihadism is this appropriation of Allah, of ascending to the throne of Allah's judgment, speaking on behalf of Allah, as the Ayatollah Khomeini would say later, to oppose the Islamic State is to oppose God. Azzam especially promoted violence and the necessity of shedding blood, and the idea that none of the aims of jihad and the purification of humanity can be attained without blood. Blood is absolutely necessary. Sharia is also, Sharia is not just religious law or Islamic law. Sharia is a means of purification. Again, purification is the key here. Purification is necessary to salvation, to redemption, not just to, cleaning up the neighborhood. And so if we followed Sharia for a week, Palestine would not only be emptied of the Jews, but purified of the Jews. Osama bin Laden, everybody knows bin Laden. Bin Laden, that's associated with Al-Qaeda. Among bin Laden's teachers were Abdul Azam and Muhammad Qutb, the brother of Saeed Qutb. Bin Laden was very close to Hassan al-Turabi in Sudan. In fact, he married one of Turabi's nieces, I believe. And Hassan al-Turabi was the Muslim Brotherhood ideologue in Sudan. Bin Laden, therefore, thinks in terms of the ideology of the Brotherhood. Bin Laden is very specific on the enmity, as he calls it, between Islam and the Jews, and from the beginning. We have his remark that resurrection will not come before the Muslims fight the Jews. This is from the Al-Bukhari Hadith, as a matter of fact. But note again, the problem is not that they occupy Palestine, so-called. The problem is that they threaten the salvation of the soul, the resurrection of humanity, the overcoming of death. Okay. There can be no peace with Satan. There can be no negotiation with Satan. Al-Zawahiri, who's currently in control of at least a segment of Al-Qaeda, he was very close to bin Laden. Al-Zawahiri was much more of a thinker than bin Laden. Bin Laden had deep pockets, but was not a deep thinker. And some of Al-Zawahiri's teachings and positions regarding jihad, the necessity of jihad, and peace with Israel, it's not only a bad idea politically, it is evil. It's evil. And because the Jews control the West, they corrupt the West. All the corruption in the world is from the Jews. The Jews, it's not that all Jews are evil, it's all evil is Jewish. With the Islamic Revolution, you have the establishment of basically a Muslim Brotherhood state in Iran. Following everything that Al-Khomeini, following everything he learned from the Brotherhood, seeing the Jews as the evil threatening humanity from the get-go. It's as if Islam were established in order to save humanity from the Jews. Okay. They're opposed to the foundations. They threaten Islam, therefore they threaten not just Muslims, they threaten humanity. Islam is the key to the salvation of humanity. Hezbollah, very active. Their current leader, Hassan Nasrallah. Hezbollah is not only supported by Iran. Hezbollah stems from Iran ideologically, right? In terms of their indoctrination. So you go from Brotherhood to Khomeini to Hezbollah. Some of Nasrallah's statements, if you notice the second one, he refers to the Jews. If we search the globe for a more cowardly, weak, and frail individual in his spirit, ideology, religion, we will never find anybody who's worse than the Jew. I'm not saying Israeli. This is not about Israelis. This is not about Israelis. And notice this last statement, that the Muslims must use any means at their disposal. Osama bin Laden made similar statements. Ayatollah Khomeini makes similar statements. Khamenei makes similar statements. Any means necessary, any means at our disposal to kill the Jews. Right now, there are talks going on with Iran and their nuclear program. In my view, you to ask the Iranians to abandon the nuclear weapons program is like asking them to abandon Islam. They won't do it. They can't do it. Now, there are some splintering groups that came out of the Muslim Brotherhood. One turn of events that brought about the splintering was Camp David. When you have Fathi Shaqaqi breaking away from the Brotherhood to form Islamic Jihad. From Islamic Jihad, you would get Palestine Islamic Jihad and other movements, dedicated to the destruction of the Jewish state, dedicated to eradicating the Jewish cancer. I noticed the language of disease, corruption, contagion. Another breakaway from the Brotherhood was Abd al-Salam Faraj, founder of Tanzim al-Jihad. Faraj was executed in 1982 for the assassination and his involvement in the assassination of Sadat. And again, he underscores the point that jihad is about fighting the Jews and killing the Jews. And other non-believers, the Christians as well, and heretical Muslims for that matter. The jihadists have probably killed more Muslims than they have Jews. Like ISIS, like this guy, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. ISIS was a breakaway from al-Qaeda. ISIS broke away like al-Faraj in Egypt because they felt that al-Qaeda had to go to more extremes, had to take more extreme measures in jihad. We know he was found and killed in 2019, and Abu Ibrahim is his successor. Al-Baghdadi had plenty of pronouncements regarding Israel, and we're going to come get you. There's some other offshoots. Here, the Houthis, Abdul Malik al-Houthi is an offshoot of, he associates with al-Qaeda, he associates with Iran. The Houthis are supported by Iran. These are the guys in Yemen who launch attacks on Saudi Arabia now and then. But they come, that you can follow the line from the Houthis to the Iranians to Qutb to Albana, Zionist lobby is planning to enslave the Muslims to corrupt the world. This is a war for freedom. This is a war for salvation, and not just a war of that's reducible to political elements. In North Africa, Al-Qaeda Maghreb is an offshoot of Al-Qaeda. Druko recently passed away and was recently succeeded by Ubaida Yusuf al-Anabi. Druko was among those who, of course, is opposed to the Jew Crusader in Gaza, Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia, and you can see his position here, the religious necessity of fighting the Jew. Drukta was involved in training Boko Haram. Remember these guys. And Abu Bakr Shekau was the leader of Boko Haram for up until this year. Of course, within these jihadist groups, you have their own infighting. Shekau was killed this year in a clash with the Islamic State of West Africa, who sees itself as a branch of ISIS. And Boko Haram is trained by Drukdel, who sees his movement, Al-Qaeda Maghreb, as a branch of Al-Qaeda. So you got these branches, but these branches are traceable to, again, the Muslim Brotherhood, if you follow over the years the lines of influence. Ahmed Umar in Somalia, the leader of Al-Shabaab, identifies himself and his movement, Al-Shabaab, at times. Sometimes you'll say we're Al-Qaeda, sometimes you'll say we're ISIS. So you have all of these genealogical connections from the Muslim Brotherhood, and there are more. I mean, for the sake of time, there are more. And there are connections between the Brotherhood and various organizations and movements in the United States and Europe, throughout the world. The Muslim Brotherhood is vastly wealthy now. They fund many organizations, and they exercise influence in many places in the world. And this is one example from the UK. These connections with the Brotherhood are outlined in a work called The Project, which is, you know, it's kind of a strategic plan for an infiltration. And you have this shift in strategy in many places on the part of the Brotherhood, where it's a shift from violence to politics and social movements and money, just exercising influence with money. In North America, the explanatory memorandum is another document explaining the activities and the plans, strategies of the Brotherhood for North America. You can see the organizations here, not the least of which is BDS. Okay, BDS has its ties with the Brotherhood. The Brotherhood has its ties with, you see at the bottom, the National Students for Justice in Palestine. The Students for Justice in Palestine are on more than 200 campuses in the United States and Canada. They are the ones, among the ones, who organize the annual Israel Apartheid Week. They are very vocal supporters of BDS. And in case, I always like to show this, and I'm about to wrap it up, lest we think this is about, you know, occupying the West Bank, and if only the Israelis would leave, everything would be fine. Muhammad Hussein Yaqub assures us, an Egyptian sheikh, that if the Jews left Palestine to us, would we start loving them? No. That they are enemies, not because they occupy Palestine. They would be enemies if they did not occupy a thing. Our fighting with the Jews is eternal. It's metaphysical, it's theological, okay? And it will go on until not a single Jew remains on the face of the earth. And my last slide, so what do we do with this? I mean, one of the most problematic aspects of our situation is there's a lot of either intentional or unintentional blindness to who the Muslim Brotherhood and what the Muslim Brotherhood is. And we have statements like this from James Clapper. You know, they're a heterogeneous group. I mean, they have their differences, but they are not largely secular, and they have not eschewed violence. They will pursue any means necessary, whether it's the Iranian project, to develop nuclear weapons, or whether it's the explanatory memorandum for funding, you know, endowed chairs and Islamic organizations in North America. Thank you all. Thank you.
Thank you so much, David. That's a lot. That's a lot to take in, and very important. to you know, how you mapped out everything. So I appreciate you know, trying to give us a concise understanding of all of this. There are a lot of questions coming in. As you know, let's now, just to be clear, now the Q&A is now open. So if you haven't typed in your question, if you have more questions, you can feel free to either raise your hand or type the questions into the chat. Let me take the prerogative, David, as the moderator, and ask, you know, go back to your last point about the connection between the Islamist jihadist ideology and how it trickles down into the you know, related to our space, the college campus environment, you know, the movements on campuses. You know, over the past few years, you know, more than a few years, we've seen, obviously, since 9/11 and prior, really, I would say since the 1960s, to be clear, an investment of Arab money, Palestinian money, that has gone into a lot of these areas. What are you, if you can expand a little bit upon that, how do we deal with that when it comes to, or what has been successful to your mind when it comes to the campus environment? If we know that these are indeed clearly foreign terrorist organizations, how are we dealing with that when it comes to campuses and preventing that kind of making a distinction between terrorist ideology and the legitimate discourse that should be happening on campuses?
Excellent question. There are a couple of projects underway. I'm working with ISCAP and Charles Small now, as a matter of fact, on a money, Following the Money project. So Following the Money tells you a lot about the situation, and there's hope. We're finding there's a whole bunch more money to be followed than we realized. Charles Small has met with people in the federal government to talk about this problem. So there are Follow the Money projects going on. Part of the difficulty is that the, you know, the anti-Semitism, whether it's you know, jihad, hard jihad or soft jihad, manifests itself largely as anti-Zionism, which on many campuses has become not only acceptable and fashionable, but morally required. Anti-Semitism is becoming, and certainly anti-Zionism is becoming, throughout academia, and I would say in the society, in the social media, more and more mainstream. As it becomes more mainstream, we become more blind to Muslim Brotherhood and Islamic Jihad. We become blind to the ultimate agenda, which is an exterminationist agenda. So, I mean, Follow the Money is one thing that can be done about it. I think senior faculty like me have to do things like this, have to say something, have to speak up, because, as many of you know, people's careers can be jeopardized by being pro-Israel or saying anything questioning the anti-Zionist agenda. That can, we all know colleagues who have had trouble in that regard. So it's incumbent upon those of us who are more senior to say something, to call it what it is, to raise questions. With ISCAP, we do a lot of editorial writing, op-ed things. But the Following the Money will make universities more careful about reporting. Many of them don't report. We found out, you know, where the money's coming from.
Great, thank you. Obviously, there's a lot to be tracking on this issue, and obviously, there's a lot to be looking at as far as where the money is coming from and what it's producing on campuses. Right. There are a variety of questions, so let me try to get to them, and with the time that we have, and try to tackle some of this. So let me take Claire Wolford's question, and she's asking, what is the role of women in Islamic Jihad? Should they train or fight, or are they just to produce to make children, or are they there to become jihadi martyrs? I guess if you could talk about the role of women and children within the architecture you've described.
That's a good question. Article 18 of the Hamas Charter says that the highest duty of a woman is to have babies and bring them up in the path of jihad. So this Hamas Charter, this is from the Hamas was founded December 1987. The charter is from August 1988. So it's not ancient history, but it's at that time, women generally were not understood to be mujahideen, warriors. However, there is, what you might call a kind of women's liberation, in quotes, in the jihadist world, where you find more women involved in, fighting. This is kind of a hard cognitive shift for jihadists to make, since they claim to be purists and keeping with Sharia and traditionally Sharia and the purist movements would not include women on the battlefield, so to say, but they certainly would include women in all the other fronts, and there are more and more fronts. I mean, the most insidious jihadist fronts now are the nonviolent ones. Academia, social media. It's very troubling. It's very troubling. And as we all know, anti-Semitism is on the rise. As anti-Semitism increases, tolerance for violence toward the Jews increases. Violence toward the Jews is happening. But yeah, the role of women in promoting jihad is there. And in my brief limited experience, women have played a role, Islamic women whom I know, in challenging jihad and exposing jihad as a false way. I know of a couple of women that I've worked with, Muslim women in that regard.
Great, thank you. So there are two questions that I'm going to try to connect here for you, David, related, and if you want to touch a little bit on this part. As you know, that the Israeli government currently has a party that is part of the Muslim Brotherhood, as far as the Islamist party vis-a-vis Ram. And the question is your thoughts on including such a group and how long can that last, and the connection between, Mansour Abbas, and the Ram party, and how that affects Israeli politics. And if you want to talk a little bit about some of what we're seeing now as far as the current configuration of the Israeli government. You don't have to give a political position, but just to kind of talk about that involvement vis-a-vis the Islamist connection.
Yeah, thank you. That's for such an uncomplicated question, but that's a very complicated.
Yes.
And I don't, I don't like to make predictions. Two things come to mind. The emergence of this party can be an opportunity to expose an agenda. However, if when we speak about anti-Zionism on college campuses and on the, in certain quarters of the left, the Israelis have their share of that phenomenon, right? So how far that extends in Israeli society will determine how, in academia, will determine how acceptable the shifting political landscape will become. I don't see, frankly, I don't see any prospect for very much political success on the part of those who sympathize with Islamic Jihad or and Muslim Brotherhood. I just to think of the Muslim Brotherhood having any kind of viable presence in Israel outside of Gaza and the West Bank is just, you know, I can't imagine it. Maybe I don't want to imagine it. But they're on the border and they're in the neighborhoods. I mean, they are in Israel. They are in Israel.
Fair enough. Good question. Next question by Stephen Jackson. And let me try to, and I'll, you know, you touched on it a little bit, but he wants to expand on it. You know, given the you know, the amount of documented money that has infiltrated the academy and established, you know, an entrenched system of, you know, these programs, what can be done to expose and reverse this trajectory on college campuses? You know, this is something that's been going on for years and years, and some of these monies have been exposed, and some of them, you know, through DOJ and other places. And again, as far as tracking that, I will also add, I'll let you answer that question, but let me also ask the obvious question as it relates to the narrative on campus. Do the Abraham Accords, you know, have, you know, are they a route also to use as a way to try to combat some of this stuff, to try to show, you know, a different side of the Muslim Arab world? And, yes. You know, and is that making any difference one iota as a way, you know, tracking on the one side and exposing the money, but also giving a different twist to actually what the reality on the ground actually is, using the Abraham Accords as a springboard for that? So if you can tackle those two matters.
Yes, no, that's an excellent point, excellent insight. The Abraham Accords opens the door for explaining the complexity of the Middle East. When you say Middle East, but you're talking about a wide range of dynamics and cultures and thinking. Each country has its own character. The Abraham Accords is an indication that not everyone is a jihadist, right? Which is certainly true. Israel and Jordan and the UAE just signed an agreement to set up a big array of solar panels for solar energy. So we got, that's a perfect opportunity. They are sensitive to the environment, and we can work together for green energy and so on. A key to understanding any of this is knowing something about history and knowing something about, you know, the current events and how they're connected. Most people know very little about history, and most people don't follow current events, but when something like the Abraham Accords arises, or any kind of treaties or cooperation arises, it's not only something we could point out, yes, look, they can get along together, but how do the Arab states see the threat of jihad? And they do see jihad as a threat to their own countries. The part of the problem on college campuses lies with the curriculum. When you have Middle East study centers funded by money that comes from Muslim Brotherhood interests and similar interests, it's hard to determine a curricular alternative. And finally, with regard to following the money, that has become extremely challenging. We need, and I just speak from a little experience, we need the experience of people who have very high tech capabilities digital electronic transactions. There's what part of it is people don't carry suitcases full of cash. It's all electronic. Practically, it's almost all electronic, and there are not a lot of people who have the high tech capability to follow these lines of the flow of money, you know, and money transfers. But I can tell you from what I've discovered so far is hundreds of millions of it go unreported, which is not legal. So there are illegal implications. That, and this remain, this is only beginning to unfold.
Great, thank you. Next question. I know we're getting short on time, but let me try to get to one or two more questions before our time is unfortunately up. The Barry Warner's question regarding the involvement of Nation of Islam, and maybe you want to talk about the Nation of Islam in connection maybe to what we've been seeing with Black Lives Matter, and tying into the larger chart you've described there, if you want to talk about their involvement.
Well, their involvement comes most directly when things like when the Israelis defend themselves against rockets coming from Hamas out of Gaza, then Nation of Islam, Black Lives Matter are right there in the forefront to champion Hamas. Again, the part of the problem is when we hear Patrice Cullors or Louis Farrakhan taking the part of Hamas, when we hear women's studies organizations saying that the Palestinian cause is a feminist cause, or the Hamas, when the problem is very few people know what Hamas is. How many would you guess have actually read, never mind studied, the Hamas charter? Of course, someone may say, well, they revised that. They didn't revise it. They changed some of the language, but it's the essence is the same. So part of the challenge is with when you have leaders like Black Lives Matter, Nation of Islam, their strategy is not to inform, but to incite, not to analyze, but to, incite, to stir things up. Responding to that can be done, I guess, in an academic setting, maybe. Let's, have a discussion, but it's a huge challenge. Social media is ridden with incitement, much more incitement than analysis of anything. We can just keep trying. People like Asaf and the rest of us can have to keep talking, have to keep teaching, have to keep pointing out, implications, ramifications, and the reality of what's around us.
100%. I mean, I think that you're absolutely right. I mean, part of, exposing the connection, seeing where, to your point before, tracking the money is critical, knowing exactly what monies are coming into our institutions, where these monies are tainted money. I mean, this all relates, of course, something that many of us have been involved in, including SPME and including, you and others, as far as tracking Middle East Studies centers, tracking the money. And making sure universities understand what the ideology that is linked in to these monies, and obviously how that trickles down into campus culture, the campus politics, and of course, the kind of quote unquote at times scholarship that has been hijacked by these narratives. And this is
Yes. Oh, that's one of the most dangerous developments. This is the hijacking of the scholarship, the demand that a scholar adopt a certain outlook, a certain ideological outlook, in order for his or her scholarship to be regarded as legitimate. This is a very real problem. There's less and less free inquiry, so to say.
A lot less free inquiry as far as what's happening. And to your point before, your earlier point in the beginning of your talk, I mean, I think that it is clear, and many of us, in the audience here, and everybody, and many of us have tracked the statements that came out after the war, the last war in Gaza in May, where departments and associations have adopted wholeheartedly templated statements condemning Israel with ethnic cleansing and apartheid and things of those that nature and those tropes that have played into the conversation. If anybody had any illusions about where people stood before, it is clear, you know, what is coming out now, you know, under the guise of these umbrellas, you know, these departments and associations.
Well, yes, but in the language of those statements, it has to be noted. I mean, they accuse the Israelis of crimes against humanity. That's the language. Comparisons with Nazis. This kind of demonization is a foundational to anti-Semitism, to an exterminationist anti-Semitism. And once Israel gets labeled as an apartheid state, then the question is, well, what is morally required in dealing with an apartheid state? Has to be dismantled. Has to be dismantled.
Right.
So it makes, again, it makes this not just a political issue, but a kind of a metaphysical issue about dealing with an ultimate evil, which is Israel and Israelis and Jews. It's this metaphysical dimension that results in Jews in, you know, in Seattle being attacked when Israelis are fighting with Hamas, you know, and responding to Hamas in Gaza.
Right. It's 100%. I mean, I think that these are the issues of the day. Unfortunately, David, our time is up, and you know, I know we did not get to all the questions, but I do want to thank you for the fascinating conversation and unpacking a lot of this. There is clearly a lot more to discuss, and I hope you can come back at a later date as well.
Be glad to.
I want to thank the audience as well for joining us as always. I apologize we did not get to everybody's questions, you know, as I said in advance. Please feel free to email us your questions at bdsmonitor@spme.org, and we will do our best to follow up and answer them, you know, as soon as possible. So I want to thank everybody again for joining us this afternoon. I want to thank David again for taking the time to talk to us, and hopefully you can come back at a later date. And I hope everybody is staying safe and healthy. And please be on the lookout for more notices for our next webinars. Have a good day, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Thank you all.